Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only.
Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Welcome to Reimagining Liberty, a show about the emancipatory and cosmopolitan case for radical liberalism. I'm Aaron Ross Powell. You can think of this episode as a kind of soft reboot, or a back to basics. This is a show about politics, but it's a politics grounded in a particular set of values and a particular perspective, and with the political and policy specifics downstream of those. Ever since the election, I've spent a lot of time on those specifics, as well as on the policy details of what the forces of a liberalism are up to. And that's important. But I want to bring the show back, at least a bit more, to those values and that perspective. What is it about the kind of radical liberalism motivating this show that sets it apart? What are those values? What is that perspective? So today's episode is the start of a conversation on just that, and it's framed around change. I've brought back my very first guest and my dear friend, Corey Massimino. He has been, it is fair to say, one of the biggest influences on the evolution of my intellectual and moral approach to politics over the last 10 years. We talk about how our views have shifted, what it means to be a radical liberal, and what sets the kind of radical liberalism at the heart of Reimagining Liberty, apart from the right-leaning libertarianism many are familiar with. Corey is an independent scholar and a fellow at the Center for a Stateless Society, where he hosts the podcast Mutual Exchange Radio and also The Long Library. If you value Reimagining Liberty and our vision of a more humane and expansive radical liberalism, I encourage you to become a supporter. You won't just be helping us keep the lights on, but you'll also get a special version of the podcast that is free of ads and sponsorships, and where you can listen to every episode a week early. You can also join the Reimagining Liberty Discord community. To learn more, check out my Patreon at patreon.com/AaronRossPowell or look for the link in the show notes. And if you just want to stay updated about this podcast and my writing, head to that same Patreon and click join for free. You'll get notified when I publish a new essay or release a new episode. You'll get sneak peeks of upcoming shows, and I'll send you my latest blog posts as well. With that, let's turn to my conversation with Corey. How did you think about politics 15 years ago that's different from how you think about it today?
Yeah, 15 years is a long time, I guess, like for me as an individual and for like the state of the world. So both things have shifted a lot. I was a libertarian, and I still am, but I guess very, you know, pretty starkly different kinds of libertarians exist, and I would say, you know, I was a few years kind of, you know, we're talking about 2010, so Obama era. I was a few years getting into politics, thinking about politics, reading some of the, you know, canonical thinkers, Milton Friedman, Hayek. And I was definitely cutting my teeth on a lot of the economics of it. That's what I initially studied in school, you know, entwined in my interest in politics and the kind of angle into it that I had. And definitely cutting my teeth on, you know, debates about the Great Recession being very fresh. And then that was such an interesting moment, I think, because it was kind of impossible to talk about the Great Recession without talking and thinking about the Great Depression and getting kind of reviving a lot of those debates. And again, like the canonical thinkers in that regard, Hayek comes up. Friedman, of course, again. So I was never socially conservative or really identified super strongly with conservatism. I was never really religious. And I would say some of my earliest views were pretty straightforwardly libertarian, even though I didn't know that what that was at the beginning or ever heard the term necessarily. You know, views like, this seems like drugs should be legal. People should be able to have that choice and not be thrown in a cage for doing that. Sex work should be legal. Is it for the same philosophy? Those are some of my earliest, you know, views. And I'm 13, 14, 15, thinking about, you know, what people have the right to do and politics. And I would say by 2010, you know, I was self-consciously libertarian. That would have been, you know, very much like in the middle of the Ron Paul movement. You know, he ran 08 and 12. I wasn't old enough to vote in either of these elections. I would have voted in both of them if I was old enough. But then once I became old enough, I didn't want to vote in the elections, and I never have. Although I came very close in the most recent one. And I think there were, you know, I was almost swayed a few times. And I totally understand people who did, of course. I think it's very understandable. But anyway, if I could have voted in 08, I would have voted for McCain. I had in 08, like much more like standard, like I watched Fox News, like kind of maybe heard the term libertarian, maybe saw Stossel, right? But I didn't dive into that. And I was just like, well, the Republicans talk about freedom and, you know, right wingers emphasize liberty in their rhetoric and seems like their ideas a little more so maybe than Democrats, I thought. And I think I believed a bunch of like weird, naive things about Democrats, thinking they were, you know, socialists or communists or something. In 2012, I would have voted hard for Ron Paul in the primaries. In the general, I probably would have voted for, I guess, Gary Johnson, libertarian, because I was really, by 2012, had become more staunchly libertarian. I had seen a little more how the Republicans were also deeply anti-liberty. And by then I saw more of an equivalence between the right and the left, at least as organized political entities, than I did in 2008 when I like maybe, you know, would have slightly preferred the right. So I would say I went from kind of bog standard libertarian views, emphasis on economics, deep skepticism of the left. And I moved over a few years and then, you know, for many years have viewed that kind of libertarian as insufficient, and mistaken in a number of ways. So I'm much more skeptical of the right, and the right has also become a lot worse. So it's kind of easy, you know, but I was getting more skeptical of the right even before it got worse, you know. Pre-Trump even starting to, you know, totally change my view on that. And I've gotten more left-wing, is one way of describing it, in my libertarianism and coming to see a lot more continuity with my libertarian ideas that I've always had and left-wing ideas, like feminism and gay liberation and things like that, which some libertarians have emphasized in history, but not enough. Especially not enough lately. So my views have changed a lot, but in some ways they're fundamentally the same. The same fundamental values of, you know, live and let live, I feel like has guided a lot of my views. In some ways, I think that might be insufficient at some level of analysis, but it's a really good thing to start with. And it's what I started with. And it gets you to a lot of basic libertarian ideas that I think are totally correct still. What about you?
I think there's a lot of overlap. And I was taking some notes on some things that you said that I think really speak to how my perspective has changed. So 15 years ago, I would have been at the Cato Institute for a year. And I had prior to that, so through law school and undergrad before that, I had mostly been focused on what you might call kind of like the canonical mainstream libertarian texts. And these were texts that were had a heavy fusionist kind of right libertarian influence. So I had read, I'd read Rothbard, I'd read Mises, but I'd also read like Thomas Sowell a lot because he's very popular among kind of right libertarians. I'd read Nozick, who is like his place is more complicated, but he's, you know, liked by. I hadn't read Rand. I think I had tried to read Rand and was like, this just doesn't work for me at all. And but I had kind of like the mainstream, you know, if you like everything Ron Paul was saying sounded great kind of view, I think. But colored by this politics that was, I had, you know, spent in high school a lot of time in like the Detroit punk rock scene and was reading the kinds of things that one reads in the Detroit punk rock scene. And
what is that? Give me an example.
Noam Chomsky. Everyone, they're always, you'd go to shows and it was like, no matter what the band was, on the merch table would be like t-shirts and some 7 inches and then like some Noam Chomsky pamphlets. So there was like that kind of like left perspective. But what stood out to me and what you said that I think like speaks to kind of this shift that I have experienced, because I did an episode recently of the Liberal Currents podcast with Samantha Hancox Lee, and she asked me how my political views had changed. And this kind of prompted our conversation today. And what I said, like a lot of my actually like looking back, a lot of my policy views, like my views about the proper size and scope of government and what the law should be, and there's some tinkering around the margins, but like the broad hasn't really changed a lot. I still like firmly believe that a free market economy is both the best way to create wealth for the broadest number of people and is emancipatory, that private voluntary action solves problems more efficiently and in more innovative ways and with less violence and routes around a lot of the really bad incentives that exist with state, like all of those things. But it's been more a shift in perspective. And I think what you said, so you made 2 points that I noted down that I think really are central to this shift. So one is you noted like you were kind of back in the days you would have voted for McCain, that right-wingers talked about freedom. And it was very interesting in the last election to see like Tim Walz and Kamala Harris start to embrace like a rhetoric of freedom in kind of taking it back, which I think was the right thing to do because the right has just abandoned entirely any commitment to individual liberty. But it was true. They like back then they did. And there was a credulity in believing them. That I had a much great, like, I was much more credulous about Republicans actually meaning it. And then the fact that Democrats didn't talk about it felt telling. But of course they did to a great extent. But they were talking about social freedoms a lot more than the right was and so on. And so there was this kind of credulity towards that. There was a sense that this is baked into like the libertarian movement at the time, that really the only freedoms worth talking about are economic freedoms. Or to it, like in a more charitable way, that all other freedoms are basically downstream of economic freedoms. Like if you don't have that, you don't have any of the others, which is there's some weight to that argument. But what that kind of meant in practice is that you don't really worry a lot about the other ones, and you just talk about the economic freedom and maybe like the war on drugs as like a social freedom. And this enabled you to talk more with Republicans because you could agree, at least they rhetorically liked economic freedom. It turned out they most of them didn't really mean it, but they rhetorically liked it. So you could talk about it. They certainly liked like cutting regulations in various ways. So there was that. And then there was also the other thing you mentioned was it believed Democrats were socialists or communists. And this was also very much in the air. Like I think there was this is the other thing that I came to notice over time is the way that like kind of right libertarian fusionist project was built around like the Cold War goes on kind of thinking that fusionism rose up. Fusionism for – we talked about it on the show a fair amount, but for listeners who don't, it was this idea that essentially in the middle of the 20th century, it kind of emerged that libertarians should, for strategic tactical reasons and for like philosophical affinity reasons, basically view themselves as part of the right conservative coalition and ally with the right against the left. That you had to pick a side and the proper side to pick. And they had philosophical reasons for this. They had moral reasons for this. They had like practical, pragmatic policy reasons, but that was the idea. But that rose up in the Soviet Union is the greatest threat to liberty era. And when the Soviet Union died, it became harder to like hold together. The discontinuities between libertarianism and conservatism became more apparent. And one way that you could kind of keep that together was to say, well, the Democrats are like basically the Soviet Union present in America. Right, like they're socialists, like command and control economy socialists, or they're communists, or they're just a slightly shaded version of the Marxism. And so the Cold War struggle goes on, and we still have to be allied against this common enemy. And so I think the other area where I shifted in that was not like I didn't come to see the Democrats as libertarians. Because they're not. Like their economic policies are like anti-market in all sorts of ways. But to realize that they were – the difference between them and the Republicans was much smaller than the difference between them and Stalin or Mao or North Korea. And that both parties weren't the kind of radically freed markets that you and I would advocate for by any stretch of the imagination, but that this was like a – these guys are so bad that you have to stick with anything no matter how bad it is. And so I think that's where a lot of my views came to change was noticing where these kinds of gaps in attention were. So caring about certain kinds of abridgments of liberty, but like not worrying so much or downplaying others, downplaying the effects of racism and misogyny in society, sneering at anyone who would talk about those kinds of things, whether those were feminists or race theorists, dismissing it as, you know, these aren't actual forces at work. They're like, they're kind of pretend or the market will just drive them out naturally, which I don't think works because it turns out like people will pay a lot to be racist. Like they'll bear a lot of costs in order to be racist or misogynistic. So there was like a noticing of that, and that's being bound up with this affinity or this kind of alliance with or cultural connection to the right. And then this like – and this became, you know, this becomes increasingly clear over time as the right goes in the Trumpist like really horrific. You know, before Trump, there was kind of the like Josh Hawley style populist, more intellectualized version of this stuff. And then it became really clear with Trump 2.0, which is, I mean, I think like an openly fascistic ideology, of like this kind of both sidesing that was very prevalent, or this notion that like, well, we have to stick with the right because the right at least is not as bad as the left, became increasingly just like obviously not, you know, not a tenable position because the right was just abandoning, or if it wasn't abandoning, it was like it was dropping its rhetorical commitment to this stuff and kind of going back to what it actually historically long had been. The rhetorical commitment to this stuff pops up with like Goldwater and Reagan and continues through maybe like Paul Ryan. But you know, that wasn't what the right was before then. The right before then looked like. And so I think that's what's really shifted, is this like this more expansive view of like whose liberty matters and where there are abridgments and how much we should care about different categories of abridgment. And then recognizing that, yeah, the right, the rhetoric was just rhetoric and it was temporary rhetoric. And they didn't really mean it. And that a lot of the ones who said they meant it, really what they meant was, right now we think that the left is culturally and politically dominant. And that means that when the state acts, it acts in order to advance leftist goals and values in both the economic realm and the social realm. I don't like those goals and values. Therefore, I oppose the state and think that we should have freedom, because freedom is like the absence of state intervention in these cases. But that wasn't actually a commitment to like robust liberty for all and social dynamism and pluralism and cultural diversity and individual autonomy and all of that. It was instead like, we see the state as a threat to our preferences, but now that we are ascendant, well, this is an awfully powerful tool to like enforce our preferences, to strip away all of those freedoms so that people who are disfavored groups are driven from public life, or just otherwise like social engineering effectively through via state action. And this became really obvious during like the post-Obergefell world with the attacks on trans people who, you know, everyone had been, there's not more trans people now than there were before. And they weren't suddenly demanding things that they weren't before. It was just this kind of cultural decision that here is a group that we can target. You know, it used to be gays and lesbians, but Obergefell kind of took a lot of that off the table, and there was rising acceptance of, but here's a group where the acceptance is lower because it's like weirder to a lot of people. They're much more of a minority. So we can target them in order to stir up culture war stuff and justify, you know, state interventions. So I'm rambling a bit, but like, I think this is what, like those two things you said, I think were like very much in the water when I was early in politics, and then realizing that both of those were not quite right, really impacted then like the shift in perspective that I had.
Yeah. I mean, I think fusionism was always a kind of, there was uneasiness and tensions, and it wasn't, you know, it's not like you didn't have, you know, libertarians and people on the right critiquing fusionism during the heyday of fusionism. But yeah, when you get into the canonical libertarians and you get into political activism and libertarian sphere, it feels all, you know, you don't even realize the stuff that you're really taking for granted about navigating the political space of the United States and And yes, often without realizing, implicitly, you know, deprioritizing certain issues or liberty for some, as you described it, and implicitly, maybe without realizing, you know, raising the priority of liberty for others and other issues. And it's just, become increasingly impossible and untenable to maintain this strategy. And it feels like it's making apparent strands that have existed the entire time in libertarianism and bring them to the forefront. And you have some folks, I think, who and were examples of seeing this tension and then coming to better clarify and understand our ideas in their historical context, and versus other libertarians who seem to be on board mostly, or again, deprioritizing everything you just mentioned about the last 10 years of the increasingly unlibertarian right wing, and either embracing or just not really caring about suddenly the state is being used for social engineering, and suddenly the scapegoating of minorities, whether it's trans people or immigrants or whatever, has escalated wildly. And that stuff obviously can never be libertarian, but this stuff has made the, I guess, quote unquote, battle lines more clear, where I think that it was an uneasy and almost on a certain level self-deceptive sort of alliance with fusionism.
The way I might frame that divide, and I think this is the way that I try to tease it out in episodes of these shows, or at least to clarify like the side that I try to take in the perspective here, is it is a, I care about liberty in the sense of limiting the actions of the interventions of government in order to have a greater sphere of individual and economic liberty. I can care about that because I just want to be left alone. Like it's a self-interested form of liberty. Like, I don't want other people telling me what to do. I want to be left alone. I want to be able to do the things that I pursue. I want to be able to maintain the possessions that I have acquired, etc. And that's something we all feel that. You don't like, none of us like to have our freedoms impinged by others. But I don't think that that is the reason that you should say, like, dedicate your life to advancing political goals, or the reason why we should, like, that should not be the lens through which you view the political project, because the political project is about everyone else you share the world or the country or the polity with. And so the other reason to care about liberty is basically compassion, is like the absence of liberty is harmful to the people who feel that absence, who are subject to arbitrary power, to the abuses of the state in whatever form it takes. And so even if like I have it pretty good, the fact that there are people who don't and are suffering from this, like, I should care about that. It's a view that like we actually have certain kinds of like obligations in how we relate to the people that we share the world with, and that we should have an attitude of like concern for others. And that if all you really care about, and this doesn't describe many people, but we'll just kind of for the sake of argument or illuminating the distinction, like if all you care about is me and mine, like, and you genuinely just don't care about other people, that's the sign of like a broken psychology, an unwell perspective on the world. That's not something that you should say like, well, therefore, like this is kind of the grounding of my life, because you should try to find a different grounding. And I think that's where a lot of the break, like a lot of the kind of support for Trumpism or the lack of caring, the callousness towards the victims of, is this notion that like my personal freedoms are greater than they were, or they're the same, but the people who are losing their freedoms are in these groups I just don't care about. And so I'm like cool with that. And versus say like, no, like if you are genuinely compassionate to others, you have this shared concern, this shared humanity, I can't be free unless you are kind of attitude. I want to extend the benefits of a free society to an ever-increasing group. That means necessarily caring about all those things that you kind of had to, as part of that, like the fusionist perspective, you had to just bracket aside because these were the kinds of things that like right-wingers, and I want to distinguish right-wingers from like, there are genuinely like liberal conservatives out there, like kind of pseudo-Burkean, you know, like the difference between them and like a genuinely liberal libertarian is like, they're saying like, slow down, don't break things. There's value in tradition and structures and not them, but like the right-wingers who have this like right-wing perspective of like hierarchy and domination and natural orders and in-groups and out-groups and all of that, like the traditional like right, if you look at the like the origin genesis of right-wing ideas, that there's just something profoundly wrong with that perspective.
One of the lines, the, you know, I guess aphorisms that emerged in early 2010s libertarianism that, you know, I probably didn't even realize the implications of at first, you know, the phrase, you know, it's rather than don't tread on me, the classic conservative refrain, don't tread on anyone. And it feels like, a simple rhetorical shift, but when you really think about it and then you start to have that in your mind and you see different kinds of libertarian discourse and writing and ideas and ways of thinking about libertarianism, and you start to see that that is like actually a distinction that probably runs down the middle of the whole, you know, libertarian infrastructure in terms of ideas and in terms of like the movement that emerged. And it's very similar to the line that, I don't know if it still is, but used to be on the libertarianism.org social media, you know, everyone wants freedom for themselves, but only libertarians want freedom for others, I suspect, as you're doing or something. But I always really enjoyed that. And it's the same idea, you know, freedom for me is easy, but freedom for thee, that's a little harder. And I think, as you pointed out before, freedom for me doesn't even generate anything that can be called libertarianism. I mean, freedom for you is freedom for you. That's not libertarianism. Well, I mean, if you're not going to grant freedom to other people, what does that have to do with libertarianism? It's just, right, concern for oneself, egotism, or almost a solipsism even of just, you know. So I completely agree that, you know, that is a central thing. And it's become more and more apparent as, you know, fascist regimes, you know, the thing that you crush really is empathy. And that's harder to deny every day. And empathy becomes this like shameworthy thing in public life. And like, no one believes it when anyone says anything empathetic, right? Well, they must have ulterior motives. It's like the lack of imagination to even think someone could be genuinely empathetic or concerned with the freedom of another person must be cover for their agenda of domination. And it goes to that fascist view, right? It's just all domination. There's really no genuine liberalism. It's just all games of domination and power. And so we're stuck in that. But you only get to that after like your empathy has been like your cognitive life has been like worn down and like sanded down to, at least that's the only way I can conceptualize that, to just that view that, right. It's all bullshit and it's all sophistry. It's good that I think, especially, you know, for me coming up in that early 2010s libertarianism, you started to see the cracks of fusionism, even more so by then, I think. And I agree with you that there's obviously a huge difference between like a Burkean conservatism and what can, I guess, be called a liberal conservatism and actual fascism. But part of the reason I'm not conservative really of any kind is because I think even, you know, even the soft view that like traditions and structures built up from prior generations and institutions like that, the view that we just need to conserve them, or at least slow down and not break things as you described it, which I think is a useful aphorism for any political ideology. But when that becomes totalizing of your view, that's the ground, I don't think that can be a ground of a thing either. And I think you end up then, it's harder and harder to conserve those traditions. And then you more and more forget that those traditions aren't necessarily built on any voluntary process that may be abided by the moral rules that you envision governing political life. And actually those traditions are built on violence or domination or power. And then I think you end up in fascism, you're clinging on to those things, or at least your version of those things, or you're trying to implement them back in where they've been worn down. That's what's going on a lot now. So not to harp on the liberal conservatives, I'll take their help against fascism, but I think you should just not be conservative.
Yeah, I think the way that I disagree with them is there is something. So the argument that, we have certain institutions that seem to be load bearing, and we shouldn't just haphazardly smash the load bearing institutions, because it might turn out that what you get in their place in that destruction is worse and that you can't fix it. And that's not a silly argument. Where I disagree is in the selection of which are the load bearing institutions, because there's a tendency to say, basically, all of the ones that I like, and I don't mean just government institutions, I mean cultural institutions as well, traditional marriage or certain kinds of social relationships, or the privileging of certain ways of life over others and so on. Those are cultural, social institutions that get argued that those are load-bearing. And the argument that they're load-bearing is we've had them for a long time, and society seemed particularly stable when we were maximizing those. But when you look at it, it was stable because we basically were excluding the voices of the people who felt oppressed by this. So this is a paradigmatic example. The 50s were this great time of social stability and success because we had the, and it's unless you were gay or a woman or black or but those voices are excluded from the analysis. And then the other part of it is there's these historical stories of these are natural institutions, natural ways of being, but then the fields of inquiry that actually examine the truth of those claims, anthropology, cultural studies, social history, etc., conservatives tend to be very, very hostile to those, not just in the individual points of scholarship, but just the very project itself. And it gets tarnished as the number of books that were written by right wingers about the evils of Michel Foucault. And there are issues with Foucault's scholarship that can be justifiably pointed out. But a lot of that hostility was very clearly what Foucault's project was to interrogate and try to uncover the stories of power behind what were taken to be natural institutions. And this is extremely threatening to the project of maintaining a belief that these are load-bearing and necessary, and the result of nature itself. And so starting to see that, and I think if you take those critiques seriously, what you get to is not that there's that kind of slow down, be careful form of conservatism is junk, because again, there's this that argument that you should kind of be aware of what you're doing and don't unintentionally break things is very valuable. But that a lot of the time it became a pretext for just maintaining things that were clearly not load-bearing or were in fact destructive or unjust. So it was a way to route around having to justify and having to argue about. It was kind of the way that Chesterton's fence, which is very much this argument, can get used as a shutdown critique. This exists, therefore it must continue to exist and don't ask questions. And so that's where I get off the argument with them is, okay, if you really mean that, then what we should be doing is like deeply critically examining the history of these institutions, their emergence, their voluntariness, why they persist, because they might persist for reasons other than they are good and beneficial. But there's often like a lack of interest in really doing that, or this hostility to those who even begin to undertake those projects.
Yeah, I completely agree with all that. I think conservatives overrate the knowledge embedded in within these traditions and built up institutions for the reasons you said, the processes that generated them, the voices that went into their construction were often unjust, to say the least. But then on the flip side, I mean, I think it's a deep, deep insight that we need to account for. If you're not a conservative, then you have all the more reason to like really, really deeply internalize whatever wisdom conservatives happen to have, which is the slow down and don't break things thing. But that I think that aphorism like contains a lot of things within it. In practice, I think my views towards, I guess, political strategy and shifting the world in a more just direction. My views on those things, I think, in many cases, would seem conservative in a broad sense, in that I'm very skeptical of most anything called revolution. I'm very open to the idea that historic revolutions were net bads for freedom. A lot of people really cherish some of these historic revolutions, depending on what side of the ideology you're on. But I tend to think that's some sort of mass violent conception of revolution that's definitely going to break things. I think that that's why social change, I think we need to think about it more in terms of like outmoding our existing institutions. Not just abolishing them, because then what takes their place? What's the positive vision? What's the inspiring vision? And then obviously, what's logistically going to be superior? And it's hard. How do you know in advance? It's really hard. So if conservatives overrate the knowledge embedded within historical traditions, I think non-conservatives overrate the knowledge of themselves and slip into social engineering and very easily replace Chesterton's fence with an even bigger, worse fence. So I think, I guess, and to take that analogy further, I think what I'm imagining, in terms of outmoding institutions, it's like, maybe it's like too much of a big and dangerous effort to like tear down this fence today, but we can like take down some planks and like put a door, and then like, okay, if that's okay, let's put some more doors. And then eventually everyone is like, walking through the doors and there's no problem. The norm shifts and it's this marginal tinkering that brings us closer. Developing alternative institutions, alternative ideas, alternative social infrastructures. I think that's the only way really to shift society in a more liberal and libertarian direction, because I completely agree with the conservatives in regards to skepticism of revolution and mass, overnight changes, even to a wildly unjust system, is better to try to navigate it and build alternatives. And doesn't feel like that's like a viable or live consideration to like any really most people in politics, or it's all about capturing the reins of the government and the state and then like doing what you want. And it's libertarians and liberals, I don't think that's the right way, either morally or practically. I guess I agree. Don't really tear down the fence, but like it would be nice to go in that direction.
I think that's, for me, the value of anarchism, even for non-anarchists, or of anarchist theory or anarchist praxis, even for non anarchists is, I think it's a David Graeber line where he talks about like the point of maybe anarchist anthropology or, but that these studies is you're essentially offering up to people options. You're saying like, here's alternatives of how things could work. And they, you know, you might not be aware that they have worked differently in these other places, or this particular thing that you think has to be done this way, it turns out there's people either historically or in a geographically different location, a culturally different location, who have found a way to do it like this. And so when I think about like kind of the big tent of the sort of radical liberalism that, you know, this show exists to discuss and advance, I very much see, you know, Center for a Stateless Society style anarchists as in that, even for the people who ultimately are like, this doesn't, you know, for various reasons. I was listening over the weekend to the first episode of your Long Library podcast where you talk with Roderick Long, which is about his essay on 10 objections to anarchism, I think it's called. And, you know, there are all, and 10 answers. It's a very good podcast. Roderick Long is a thinker that is underexposed. More people should be paying attention, a very thoughtful guy. But it is this, like, even if you ultimately think that one or more of those objections is dispositive, it's that like offering up alternatives. It doesn't need to be like tear down the institutions tomorrow. And I think as we're seeing right now with the Trump administration, if you just start like tearing things down, the results aren't great. But it's like, no, you should have kind of this expansive sense of the possibilities and be aware of the alternatives and then try them out. And if they work, do it more. And if they don't, do it less. But this runs up against that urge to maintain the existing systems that you see from conservatives. I think the way that kind of right libertarians who really don't like social freedoms try to frame it is that other people's social freedoms can turn into a form of not leaving me alone. Like if I have to see your trans merchandise at, you know, like Pride merchandise at Target, that's like an abridgment of my leaving me alone means not pushing your views on me. And so therefore it's wrong in a libertarian sense to like behave in these ways in my presence or to have a sufficient number of people who don't share my lifestyle preferences such that it's more challenging for me to lead my lifestyle in the fullest sense because our lives are social and we have to share them with others. Like all of those kinds of arguments. But but I think if we break those down, then yeah, you replace it with this, it's experimentation and it's like.
And also it's not even all these attempts at tearing down the fence, like in wholesale, you know, it's like you don't even end up doing that. I mean, what I think really, you know, with the Trump regime, I don't think has torn anything down. I think people have put someone in charge that they think is tearing things down. And in practice, it's more like loyalty purges and like shifting of, you know, government spending from social programs to just more direct, brutal state violence and these things. And, you know, but then somehow people think this is draining the swamp and it's all symbolic and this, you know, so yeah, absolutely. We need more sophisticated strategies and considerations with all this, you know, and for the love of God, cannot, whatever your ideology, put your hopes in like a demagogue style figure to just like enact that perfectly. Because in practice, they can't and won't. And you get this personalist, you know, autarkic type regime that somehow some people have deluded themselves into thinking has torn anything down that's worth to being torn down or that libertarians want torn down.
Maybe we can close then by having you clarify for us like what the what that alternative looks like, the perspective, taking the conversation we've had, that we ought to bring to these ultimately like the baseline political questions, which is how do we navigate sharing society with others and think about not just our liberty, my liberty to be left alone, but their liberty to live their lives in, you know, to an equal degree as I'm asking for myself.
Yeah. I think it involves, like we've both, you know, undergone a self-reflection, kind of a self-auditing of one's ideas and the implications thereof, and like not taking for granted certain ways of applying them or certain affiliations or alliances in practice that maybe a lot of people with those ideas take for granted and implement, but as we've seen, are started to wither down and become untenable. I think reconceiving of libertarian ideas as, you know, were used earlier as emancipatory, or as universalistic, cosmopolitan, you know, expanding one's sphere of moral concern outward, rather than narrowing it. And unfortunately, it's been the easy misstep, I think, to go in the other direction for some folks. But just very consciously reconceiving of it, articulating it in such terms, and obviously applying it in that way, which is kind of a never ending battle. I think one thing people miss is their view of liberty becomes, as we've discussed, like inherently combative or hostile. Like you said, like to me, seeing your views is like an impingement on my liberty. So we need a more harmonious conception of liberty, where people have their rightful spheres of expression and authority, and their equal spheres, and that's just the rock bottom of it. There's we can't indulge in domination games and power, even if we think those are some instrumentally valuable thing to like greater liberty, which they aren't. But even if they were, respectful of other people's spheres of liberty in this more harmonious conception of humanity and of our potential. That's how my views have changed in the last 15 years.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Reimagining Liberty. If you'd like to listen to future episodes free of ads and sponsorships, you can become a supporter for just a few dollars a month. Head to www.aaronrosspowell.com to learn more.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.